everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable, episode 112. Today, we are currently rewatching The Legend of Korra, and we will be discussing episode 3, The Revelation, and episode 4, A Voice in the Night. My name is Michal, and in case you couldn't tell, this is my first time hosting a Rewatchable podcast, but you might remember me from the Avatar The Last Airbender Rewatchable that we did a few months ago, or from, like, most of the news articles on Avatar and Korra, because I write most of those on Hyperbole. Today I am joined by my lovely co-superfan, spoiler alert, Mitchell.
Okay, I know, the spoilers. No, I'm good. I think I've still had my moment before we started recording the first episode of our introduction, which is still killing me that every single newbie knows the thing, and I'm just,
You're already getting close to spoiler.
I am. Look at me. The thing. This is hashtag not the beach, but hashtag the thing.
I have no idea what you're talking about. We are also joined by two newbies, perpetual newbies, and at least in my experience, because these are the only rewatchables that I've been on, Brittany and Karen.
Hi.
Hello.
If you would like to get in contact with us, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. You can talk to us on Twitter at re_watchable. There's always a lot of great discussion going on there. You can respond to this post on hyperbole.com, or you can join us on Tumblr, which is rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. So, let's dive into our first episode, which is episode 3, or chapter 3, in the Avatar style, The Revelation. The synopsis. I'm excited for this. Okay. The synopsis is, in this chapter, Mako and Bolin have to come up with enough yuans to compete in the Quidditch World Cup. Translation, the pro-bending finals. Bolin joins the ranks of the triple threat triad to get the money, but is soon captured by Equalists and set up as an example for Amon's rally. Korra and Mako sleep, not together, next to each other on Naga, and that ship emphatically sets sail, and go all Inspector Gadget on the rally. Korra is horrified to witness the triple threat triads all have their bending permanently taken away by Amon, so she stops that little party with a little of the painted lady action. The crew takes some hits from Amon's lieutenant, but Amon lets them go so that Korra will spread the messages of hope and peace that he thinks he's achieving. So what do you guys think about this episode? This, I think, is definitely the story start. You know, the first two episodes really set up the world, and then, you know, the revelation kind of goes like, well, here's what Korra's up against, and it's really intense.
Yeah, I really liked this episode, and I feel like it's already hitting those big issues that I was expecting to come a little bit later in this series, but I feel like we're jumping right into the middle of everything right away.
Yeah, we really, really are. This show just does not, or at least certainly season one, does not stop. It's on the throttle the whole time. So one of our first discussion points is kind of just about, you know, the predicament that the brothers find themselves in, meaning that they have absolutely no money. And there's a nice moment when Korra is kind of like, oh, well, I've never had to worry about money. And Mako's like, okay, trust fund baby. Like, please go back to Stanford or whatever. And
where in canon in this moment do we understand that she's gotten money? I mean, has it just been like, I lived with my parents, or I'm the Avatar, so people give me everything?
I think it was like she was living this sheltered life, like she was just taken care of, like from training to training, like she was just like never had to worry about anything.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much that she had like an endless bank account like Harry Potter did, where he can buy whatever he wants, but right. More so she like just, everything just appeared in front of her. She was not like going crazy.
Like when she was hungry in the pilot and she was like, I don't know how to get food.
Yeah, basically.
What is this barter system with coins that you're using?
Which, I mean, if you think about it, probably good knowledge for the Avatar to have. So I'm kind of surprised that they didn't like teach her how to exist in the world, even if they were trying to keep her secluded, to not be like, hey, by the way, this is money. You need this to buy food.
It's also kind of like us in high school, though. Like, you graduate high school and you're like, I don't know how to open a checking account, but I know how to solve this geometry problem. You know, it's like you're lacking a lot of life essentials, but then they're like, okay, go to college. You're an adult now. And you're like, okay, great. Where, wow. What aisle is the rice in the grocery store? Like,
no, Brittany with the parallels today. Like, you're hitting it out of the park.
Thank you.
Well, so on the other side of things, Mako and Bolin obviously have had ample experience with trying to make their own way in the world. So Bolin basically goes right back to his old tricks, not in the sexual way. that happened way earlier than I anticipated. But he, you know, he first sets up something very innocent and, you know, useless with Pabu, and it's completely adorable. And I'm sorry if you don't love Pabu by the second, then you have no soul. But he also gets swept up back up with the Triads, who are gangs that he and Mako kind of used to run with a little bit. So how did you guys feel about that?
I think it was a very innocent thing to do. I think he saw the money, knew how much they needed it, wanted to maybe not impress his brother, but to take care of him and take care of the team. And I don't think that he really knew what he was getting into, because he seemed hesitant at first, but saw that money and was just like, hey, this will solve all of our problems. And he seems like a very innocent and genuine person to me.
Yeah, and I feel like Mako was taking care of him, and he saw Mako do this all the time. Like, and it was just an in-and-out job, and he could, like, you know, make the money, like, helping them out as, like, a whatever, bodyguard or whatever he needed to do. And then it turned into something much bigger than he expected, which is sad, because I think that since he saw Bolin alone, he was just like, oh, this is easy. Like, we could just take him. He'll follow us. And if Mako wasn't around, then he kind of got into a bit more trouble than he liked.
The newbies, I'm curious, because I know that y'all really can't go on, like, the Avatar Wikia, because you'd be spoiled to heck by, like, their side articles and, you know, their pages or whatever. So then, from your own guesstimations, how old do you assume Bolin and Mako are? And, like, what's their age gap amongst that would create this relationship?
I feel like they're in their, like, Mako is probably like 19, 20 maybe.
Yeah, I'd say I was thinking maybe like 18.
And then maybe they're like 2.5 years apart.
I'd say that's fair. I can't remember. McCall probably can. If I had a guess right now too, that's what I would say. Do you know, like, our definitive answer, McCall?
I don't remember exactly, but they're all kind of in their, you know, slightly later teens. I think Mako's probably 18. Bolin's maybe 16.
Yeah, like, I would even push Mako into worked already, like, for these people. He would have, I don't think he would have started when he was like 14 or 13, you know.
I would have even, like, I wouldn't hesitate to push Mako all the way to 20 and Bolin down to like 16 from just how they act. And I know Mako's still kind of angsty. He's a lot. I mean, he's so Zuko. The more and more I watch the show, the more I realize that he has a lot of that teen angst that Zuko has. But he just looks older to me. He looks like he'd be at least 20.
Yeah, I don't think they're that. I don't think they're 4 years apart. I think they're definitely closer. Like, I think we have to. I would give Mako, like, the higher age, but then make Bolin older. Like, I wouldn't go down. Like, I wouldn't say that Mako's under, like, 18, 19.
So is it creepy in any facet that Mako would be hitting on Korra?
No, because how old is Korra? I have no idea how old Korra is. I thought she was, like, 16.
Okay, cool.
Korra's like 16, 17. I don't think Mako is 20. I think he's like 18, 19.
Yeah, even if he was 20, I feel like that's like, I mean, whatever.
Well, I mean, it brings up, you know, an interesting point. Again, kind of, well, it hammers home that idea that, you know, Korra is very innocent for her age, and Mako is very experienced for his age. Again, not in the sexual way. But... We'll get to that slightly later in the episode.
Oh, God.
So the next kind of talking point is that, well, I guess on that similar note, Korra and Mako, this ship kind of starts to sail. They have, you know, they Mako's still kind of a jerk to her at the beginning of the episode, but then, you know, they kind of get their Sherlock Holmes hats on and, you know, start hunting down Boleyn. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that sparks fly, but I think that there definitely is a bond there, that they both feel attracted to each other. So, Brittany, how did you feel about this budding ship?
I liked it. I mean, I'm into it. I love those, like, those friendships that have, like, on TV, like, that have that just, like, underlying, like, sexual tension, but, like, you know that nothing is probably ever going to come of it, but I just like that, like, give and take, like, you know what I mean? Like, the kind of, like, they like each other, but they like being in each other's company more than they like being together type of deal. So I like it.
So wait, are you saying that, is it Makora? Yeah. Makora is Zutara, like, part two?
No, because Zutara should be together and they should be like having children. And these two should just be like, hey, this is my old buddy, like, from back in the day. No.
I know, Zutara, and I'm sniffing out, like, forever. A Friends reference, like the TV show Friends here somehow, but I don't know if I know the ships well enough to feel it. But I know what you mean, Britt, that it's nice to see these kind of relationships build into themselves and not be like, I don't know. Like, it feels like when Aang was with Katara at first, he was, like, all googly eyes for her, like, the second he saw her, and it felt like a cute little kid crush, and then it got kind of creepy. But with Korra and Mako, it's like they're letting themselves evolve and test each other out, and they poke fun at each other, and quite frankly, I think he's just mean. I don't know if I really like Mako in season one, because I don't find his attitude toward her right. He's only nice to her when he needs something out of her.
Yeah, but he's had a hard life. He can't trust anyone. I get it.
And Yen Bolin's been more sheltered, so he's kind of, you know, more giddy about life.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a good point, that Mako doesn't trust anyone. You know, he's not singling Korra out to be an ass to her. He does this to pretty much everyone. But Karen, do you have any shippy thoughts?
I pretty much agree with Brittany. I like it, but I think I just want to see them as friends first, because there is a lot of that combative relationship between them. And while it's fine and sometimes it's kind of funny and, you know, picking on each other and stuff, I think that once they do become friends, it has the potential to be a really loyal friendship, because for Mako, at least, like, she has to earn her place there, and she hasn't yet. And I think if that does happen, then it's going to mean a lot, and he's going to be really loyal to her, which I would really like to see. But, yeah, for right now, I mean, it's kind of cute just to see them interacting and stuff. And I would hope that maybe Korra could bring out a softer side of him, because he can be kind of a jerk. But, you know, he has had a hard life, so it's totally understandable. Mm-hmm.
And they do work well together. I mean, you know, it's undeniable. They solve Amon's, like, jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
Maps. Which always kind of struck me as a little funny, because, like, only, like, one part of the map is highlighted, right? So if they didn't have all of those papers, it would have been like, well, now we have a piece of the Republic City map. That's nice.
Pretty much.
But, so I guess only, like, a fraction of the people who actually got those flyers were able to come to the rally, but that's okay, because Amon recruited Korra to spread his message.
But there were a lot of people at that rally. Like, for them all to figure that out, it had to be through word of mouth, effectively, because I don't think that anyone was really, like, sitting through like they were, and, like, conveniently next to, like, the subway line where they could see, you know, like, the whole map of Republic City, put up the pictures, have it to scale. Like, that was just almost too convenient for me, and I was like, I'll buy it because the story needs to move along.
And also, 12-year-olds need to put that together, so... It's not for our adult minds to have a Sherlock Holmes type of investigation.
That's yeah. True. But they do have something I did want to talk about, is we kind of have our first attack from the Equalists, and they are hardcore. They are, like, seriously hardcore. They take out Korra and Mako pretty easily and take out their bending temporarily. So how did you guys feel about that? I mean, I guess looking back on it, Mitchell, how did like these guys stand up? You know, having seen all of Korra and all the threats she faces, this kind of first emergence of these ninja-like bug-faced equalists.
Oh, I love Karen's description too, as them being ninjas, because it was so obscure to me because I've become so familiar with them, but they are kind of just like ninjas, and they're scary ninjas. These aren't just like Joe Schmoes who decided to like throw on a mask and be like, ooh, oogity boogity. These are like trained killers. They could definitely take you down in an instant. And it doesn't matter if you have bending. They have like magical dodging abilities. I don't know how they dodge the bending that they do, but they do. And it's almost kind of bringing in two Atla characters specifically, how when Azula doesn't have her bending in the Day of the Black Sun, and she's just like dodging Aang's earthbending and Toph's earthbending so easily by like jumping on the spikes that they come up from the ground with. And that's kind of what these equalists do too. So I found that parkour was really cool, that they're showing, of course, that like you don't have to be a bender to be so powerful a la Azula when she was in that episode. And then also, of course, I wrote down later in the show notes that this is the return of Ty Lee's chi blocking. So that is like a direct reference to something that we had in Atla, and maybe one of the first times we've seen something so specific as in a type of bending or something to that effect, maybe lightning bending, but come back with such a strong force. And I think that that's amazing that we can assumedly tie that back to Ty Lee, or at least someone she was associated with.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thought. It's there are a lot of things that kind of call back to skills and techniques and concepts from Avatar: The Last Airbender, and it's very interesting to kind of think about how they might have extended forward. Karen and Brittany, did you guys have any thoughts? Did you find the equalists like intimidating, or are you just like, okay, like bug-faced people, whatever?
Definitely intimidating. I think more intimidating because they don't have the ability to bend elements, and yet they can go up against the Avatar and take her bending away. I mean, temporarily, obviously, but it's crazy, and they're very strong, very smart fighters, and I like that they've got this non-bending power. I think it adds a different sort of twist and aspect to the show.
Yeah, I really liked this. I was glad that we jumped right into this like threat, only because it's very different than Avatar. And I was like waiting for it in the first two episodes, because we kind of only get like that slight little like head turn within the first two episodes where you see the masked face. And this is like this leader has risen up because he was like permanently scarred by a firebender, I think it was. Yeah, obviously, because who else would have a scarred face?
Besides Zuko.
Yeah, I like them. I think that they're terrifying, especially it's like amazing to see how far that they've come with the like lightning bending and stuff. Cause I thought it was so weird watching them lightning bend, because it was such like this elegant, like I tweeted about this when I was watching them. It was always this like elegant like thing where you had to like pass it through your body, and these guys are just like zapping it like it's nothing. And I didn't appreciate that change from it being like this, like, beautiful, beautifully explained like way to like with Iroh, and now it's just like zzz, zzz, like I'm gonna zap you. I'm like, all right, well, that's gone. But I did like that they use like the chi blocking as a tactic, because it gives them a lot of power over benders, because then they're like rendered useless.
I would wonder, Brittany, if there is yet a firebender that has reached, you know, bending maturity or whatever, that can't lightning bend, just from what you and I have noticed too. On Twitter, I remember we were talking, we were saying like, yeah, it's just so easy. And I sent you that gif of like Aang like redirecting Ozai's lightning, it being such a big thing. And you're right, like it just happens for like Mako, and he's sitting there like he's just zapping the machines like it's no tomorrow, and he's kind of sweaty, and I wonder if they're like feeding them like, you know, chai tea or something to keep their energy up. But I don't know like how you could sit there in Atlaverse, as opposed to Korraverse, if we're counting them as two separate now, and just like sit there and zap all day for like electricity. That seems like that would drain you a lot. I don't know if I could get behind that. I don't think I can. I still think I'm stuck on that. Mikhail, does it bother you?
And they're, I mean, they're not even redirecting it. They're like producing it, which is weird. Like, I just want to know how it works. You know what I mean? Because we went into so much detail with how you had to build up and train and learn how to redirect lightning. And like Azula could do anything with it. Oh my gosh, she was intense. But she was like, she had a lot of pent up rage. And I feel like everyone working in that factory doesn't really have that much rage. Maybe Mako has some deep seated rage, but I don't know. I would like a little aside about how it works, how it changed over the 70 years.
And while we're on the topic of lightning, I have to say that my eyes get very irritated whenever the Equalists use their lightning sticks or their shocking things. Now I'm thinking Jurassic World with the dinosaurs and all that, and they're shocking them. But it's kind of like that, I guess, because the Equalists are always like trying to shock people, and it makes the animation is just so like frequent. It's almost like it needs like its own seizure warning whenever there's an episode with a lot of lightning, and not even just when people produce it, but specifically with these Equalists. Does anyone else have that issue when they watch Korra?
I mean, I find it very physically disturbing, but I don't like, it's unpleasant, but I think it's, you know, it's obviously meant to be. I think we're kind of meant to feel a little bit of what Korra or Mako or whoever is feeling when they're being electrocuted.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's providing its own type of shock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it definitely feels intentional. I'll give you that much.
Yeah. And I mean, going back to the, you know, the change in the lightning, I do remember this being a topic of controversy when Korra came out and people were like, had 5 years of like revering, you know, the image of Iroh slowly building up lightning and, you know, but I mean, the way somebody explained it to me, well, I didn't really get the way they explained it to me, but the way I kind of think of it is sort of like society kind of levels up in certain ways, you know, throughout history. Yeah. Like, even if you just think about sports, like the triple axel in ice skating, you know, used to be like impossible to do. Like, nobody did that. It was like double, you know, like if you just think about like the 100-year period of ice skating, like the tricks and things that have become not only impressive, but like the standard drastically changed the more people learn how to do it. And the more people like, it, you know, these things become expected elements of people's routine. I'm talking like, I know a lot about ice skating. I really don't, but I
no, I was impressed.
That makes a lot of sense actually. And I guess like, cause Iroh was the one that developed that ability, right?
I know he was famous for breathing fire out of his mouth. I don't know if he developed lightning necessarily. Oh, wait, you're right. No, redirecting, he developed, Karen. Redirecting.
Right, yeah. So he was sort of the first person to do it, and then he taught other people. And I think that maybe as that information spread, you know, just like Mikal was saying, like, you level up. And I think the more people who started doing it and practicing it, maybe it just became a lot easier and they found their own ways to make it work. I mean, I agree with Brittany. I don't really like the idea that it's so easy now, because that was such like an awe-inspiring thing in Avatar. But at the same time, I think there is an explanation for it.
Well, maybe it's kind of like genetic, like, you know, if your predecessors had learned how to use it so successfully, and or if they were just good at doing it, if we're down to natural selection here, we could just say that the more shocky firebenders are the ones that are going to produce more successful babies that will be able to lightning bend a lot easier.
I think 70 years is a little bit too
revolution and all that, yeah.
Darwinian, you know, natural selection to come out. But
well, hey, here, I'll give you this much. There's a big gap in which we don't really understand. I don't know if this is a spoiler. I'm not going to say it. I was going to talk about, I won't give specifics. I was going to talk about the Fire Nation. That's all I'm going to say. But read the comics, people, because I would spoil you if you didn't read them yet. You'll understand my question, I think, once you've gotten to the end of the most recent ones.
Anyway, moving on, we have Amon, obviously kind of the nexus of a lot of this. And it's, you know, it's kind of the opposite of the idea of, you know, Bender's becoming more advanced because he wants to take away bending altogether. And this is, you know, the episode where we learn about his actual plan and his motivations. What did you guys think about that speech he gave? I mean, I remember being... I think that was the moment where I was like, oh, this show is real. you know, like this is like, I need to take this seriously. And I, you know, I still feel like that when I watch it. I think the guy who voices Amon's name is Steve Bloom, and he does such an amazing job. Just,
oh yeah.
Like that commanding, ruthless voice. Brittany, what did you think?
It's one of those things that you hear and you're like, I can't argue against you. I was like, I can, but it will never sound as good because I'm little old me, and like, you make a lot of good points and you're terrifying. But yeah, I like where this threat is going. Like, I really think that it's a very complicated problem and it's not going to be easy to solve. And I like it a lot. I'm very excited to see where it goes.
And what a time to be the Avatar when all this is going on. I feel like some Avatars kind of like got off easy. You know, if you can imagine the past, like we've seen some intense ones with like Kyoshi having to defeat that Chin the Great, I think. And of course, everything that happened with Roku and whatnot. But I really do feel like everyone's Avatar lifespan couldn't have been this difficult. Like there had to have been like some easy presidencies in the Avatar world.
Maybe. Definitely the skills that are being put on display here are relatively new. So, I mean, Karen, how do you feel about Amon, like, as a character? What did you think of his backstory? Were you compelled by it, or did you think he, you know, because I think one of two reactions is that, you know, you can really get on board with this and think that this is something that, you know, oh, you know what, actually he's right. Like, Bending is responsible for all the wars. Or you can be like, aren't you starting a war? You know? So how did you feel about that?
I don't want to say that I was compelled by his backstory, just because obviously he's the bad guy here and you don't want to give him too much credit, but I understand where he's coming from and I understand why a lot of the people listening to him are cheering for his idea, because it must be scary. And I think we talked about this last time. It must be scary to live in a world full of benders as a non-bender. I mean, you feel like you have no power and you always have to watch out for them, because not all benders are going to be good guys. And I think that them wanting to be on a more equal footing is absolutely, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. However, obviously this guy is not going about it the right way, and he wants to take bending away from people, and you're right, he is starting his own war. So I think perhaps the idea behind it is flawed, but, you know, something that needs to be discussed, and the way that he's going about it, probably not the best.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting to see where it goes from here, for sure. As you were talking, I was thinking, oh, we should have a Bender Registration Act.
A lot of this does start to feel like MCU, to tell you the truth.
A little bit, yeah. So the major thing that we really find out at this rally is that Amon can take people's bending away, something that has not been seen in the Avatar world since Avatar Aang, and probably hasn't been seen before that, or, you know, lion turtles aside. But I guess I'll just say, when I saw that, I was like, I was blown away for the first time. And I just... You know, because it's something that I always kind of thought, I had about 5 years of thinking that, like, I loved Avatar and I loved the ending, but, like, it's a little bit of a deus ex machina that Aang just, like, suddenly got this ability and this is a thing and we could take it away. And the first time I saw this, and I was like, oh, okay. Like, they you know, Mike and Brian didn't just use that as, like, a one-trick thing. Like, they're using this concept as something that continues to have power in this world. And I just thought that was fantastic. So Mitch, how did you consider, you know, how did you react the first time you saw Amon just like totally owning all of these criminals?
Well, the only thing I really needed to say when I saw that was, oh my God. Because back to what we were talking about on our introduction episode, moments that make me so fearful. The brutality of that is akin to some of the most horrible things in Atla that I will not reference, because they will spoil you if I even try and make a fun reference, because I'm apparently very bad at subtly spoiling even myself. I get that. So regardless, if you think of some of those brutal moments in Atla, I think you can find yourself matching up to like the brutality in Korra. Almost, I think it's almost higher, quite frankly, because this there's just such a look of fear on the mind and the person's face that's having their bedding taken away, and you can almost feel it along with them. I mean, not to just mention, of course, that we have electricity again, so we're feeling the intensity of the scene from that flashing from this firebender guy, but then also it's just really intense too, because like his eyes are bugging out and like they get really close and they have like sweat beads on their face, and you almost feel like you're in that scene. And this is a cartoon, and to say that is absolutely amazing, that it has such a realism to such a fantasy. And it chills me to the bone every single time I see a man take someone's bending away. It's such a great show too, like the whole, like, you know, the crowd's cheering and they don't care about even getting hit by lightning, apparently, because that's what I would have done if I was that guy. I don't know. I would have done something, right? But it was it's very, like, viscerally upsetting for me to see that scene.
I completely agree. I was thinking the same thing when I was watching this. Like, okay, yeah, this guy is, you know, the head of some sort of mafia and he's a bad dude and he's done a lot of terrible things. I genuinely felt terrible for him because bending is such a part of your identity. And I mean, even if we didn't have the whole backstory with Aang and everything, just look at Korra and look at how much she loves her abilities and how much she respects the power that she has. I mean, she's a very powerful person, and even the people that aren't the Avatar and can't bend multiple elements, they've been that way their entire lives. Like, take that away and it feels like you're ripping out part of their soul. And I just, what a terrible, terrible thing to do to somebody. And I know that we saw in Avatar that was an extreme case. And even though this guy was a criminal, I can't imagine what that must feel like to be without that power.
So I will say that, you know, the psychology of bending and being a bender and having that, and I guess what that means to you and the idea of having it taken away is something that becomes a very strong theme in season one. And I'm looking forward to seeing how you guys react to the rest of it.
I have a thing I want to say really quick, but mm-hmm. I'm talking to Brittany because obviously you guys can't answer my questions. So Aman has to be a bender, right? Like, he has to be a bender because only the blocking the chi thing takes it away temporarily. And the only other instance we have of somebody taking away somebody's power permanently was Aang, who was a bender. So I feel like Aman wants to take away everyone's bending and then be the only bender left and take over the world.
I feel, you know, I had the same question because, first of all, I was confused that anyone other than the Avatar could actually take away bending. Mm-hmm. I was like, wait a minute. I thought this was like a special thing. Like, it came along with Avatar territory. But I agree. I think that he was a bender and he had his bending taken away. And maybe there's something left in your body that allows you to do it. I don't know.
So but maybe he's like 200-year-old Fire Lord Ozai?
Yes.
Done. We figured it out.
And his face was burnt off by Zuko.
Oh my god.
Can you imagine?
That would be insane.
Well, if this is not true, Karen, I think we have a career as fanfic writers.
I think we do too.
No comment. We got the I've first. Heard it all things. Oh, no comment. No comment.
From Avatar Theory. That's awesome.
You guys don't know how much it's killing me to just say no comment. You know that, right?
Good job, Mitch.
You love
it,
Mitch.
So I guess wrapping up, but speaking of that fear, how did you guys think about, what did you think of Korra's response to this whole, you know, this, I guess, from her perspective, horrifying display of being very much violated? Did it resonate with you, or were you like, they're criminals? Like, how did you feel?
I mean, I appreciated her very honest response to Tenzin because I was like, okay, good. She's admitting that she's scared and she's not trying to like take on everything by herself right off the bat. I liked it. I liked how vulnerable she was and how she literally admits, like, I have no idea what to do. And I really liked that about her, because up until this point, like, I've been fine with Cora, but I've also had it in the back of my mind. I'm like, okay, she's like a little naive, but it's cute, I guess. And she's just learning how to interact with real people, and she's not training, and she's like playing on a pro bending team. And then all of a sudden I'm like, okay, good. Like, this, she's human. Like, she's not going to be like, the avatar is not going to her head. Like, she openly admits this early on that she is terrified, and you could tell, like, you could just tell through the animation how scared she is.
And following up on your point, Britt, too, you saying that's kind of cute how, like, naive she is into the world. You know, we've talked about how she's like the high school student that doesn't know how to open up a checking account. And I think that from an animation standpoint, which I know there's comments about my comment about the animation. We'll talk about that later. Regardless, from an animation standpoint, the way Cora looks when she's happy or when she's elated or when she kind of likes someone, she has these large anime eyes that aren't exaggerated. They're more natural feeling, and it almost makes me feel more, I mean, attracted to her in a way of like, I appreciate this character design. She makes me happy to look at. She's really emotive, and it's a different way than Aang, because Aang is kind of adorable in my opinion, but I think he's a lot more cartoonish. But Cora, I can see from a more human standpoint how I would find myself attracted to her personally, to say like, you're adorable, I want to be friends with you, because you just, like I said, just so emotive. And then going back into how she's so horrified, it hits you, like it punches you in the gut really hard from how much you've seen her, you know, range through all of her emotions, and then just hit this rock bottom so quickly. Like, I feel like the viewer is taken on a really unique roller coaster ride with Cora from being a cartoon.
Yeah, and Tenzin's response too. It's like you see that like level of concern, like, oh my gosh, Cora, are you okay? To, oh, this is a real threat. Like, I understand where, like, he is realizing it as she's admitting she's scared, and like, I loved that whole scene. So,
yeah, so that's pretty much where we end off. You know, Amon is like okay with Cora escaping because, you know, she's going to spread the message. As we see in the next episode, he does some of that himself as well. But so let's go through favorite scenes. Karen, what was your favorite scene in this episode?
Mine was when the bug-eyed ninjas attacked, and then Naga got free of her ropes and stuff, and she growled at them, and then Pabu jumped up in front of her and growled at them too, and I was like, oh, he's so cute.
Yes, yes, he is. I should probably say that at my first San Diego Comic-Con, one of the only things I bought was a stuffed Pabu.
So. Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah. Cool. He's in his, that's a spoiler, but he's wearing something very cute. Mitch, what about you?
Okay, so as you might have garnered, huh?
I don't know what this means.
Oh, okay, no, that's fine. As you might have garnered from my recap that I wrote, The Return of the Painted Lady, I found that to be a specific throwback to Katara's Save the Whales episode, where she has Fog come in to like kind of attack and save everyone that's being trapped by the Fire Nation in that one little town. And I found that to be similar, because Cora just feels just kind of like as unplanned as the Painted Lady scheme was, because Katara was just like, cool, whatever, I'll like save them. And Cora's just like, oh, cool, that's enough steam. And I found that to be really cute. And I personally felt it to be a direct throwback to that moment that Katara had.
Okay, I'm not sure I would agree, but I see where you're coming from. Brittany, what about you?
I just liked watching Mako lightning bend in that like factory with his like man tank on. So
and he just has a little tear in it too, so it's like,
ooh. yeah, you know, it's a hard day's work. He's working in the factory. It was almost like a throwback to like, he wasn't dancing, but it was like, it reminded me of Kevin Bacon in the warehouse in Footloose. Just doing what you can to get out all your anger.
We're, I get it, he's Kevin, kind of a Kevin Bacon.
I saw Kevin Bacon once.
It was, I did too. I watched him perform with his band, the Bacon Brothers.
Oh.
Well, now your degree of separation is a lot smaller. You know that, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I met him at like the Fox Upfronts, the fan fronts, like 2 years ago, and then his band performed there too. So.
Karen, didn't you interview him?
I did, for the following.
Oh my goodness, we all have almost, well, I don't really have a direct. I saw him when I was in my car once, or my sister's car. He was walking his dogs.
Close enough.
And my sister was like, is that Kevin Bacon? And I like cracked my eyes up and I was like, yeah, I think so. But moving on from Kevin Bacon, but I guess still talking about food in a sort of way, because I said, holy cannoli. My favorite scene was Amon's speech, because I just really, yeah, I dig it. I think this might become a theme through the rest of this season. Mitchell, what was your favorite line in this episode?
Yeah, well, my favorite line was, I suppose, I had to lead up to what Cora said by saying, Mako, and you're the rookiest of us all. We got to get you up to speed if you want to survive in the tournament. Deal with it. And Cora just comes back with, you deal with it. And I was like, oh, cool. It's like a pilot shout out. It's like baby Cora never grew up.
She you know, she picks her words and she likes them. She sticks with them. Yes. Brittany, what about you?
I picked, sounds like there's a turf war brewing and Bolin's about to get caught right in the middle of it. Because it's a very, like, dramatic, we're going to cut to commercial now moment. And I'm still not over the 1920s, like, gimmicky thing. Like, with the intro to every episode, like, I'm just not a fan of it at all. And this line, like, really threw me over the edge. Because I'm like, we're not in the 20s. We're in an Avatar universe that's kind of like the 20s. But it just, I don't think it's going anywhere, so I'm going to have to get used to it.
Not a fan of Scoochie?
No, not. I'm trying really hard to get behind it, but I'm like, ugh, it's not going to end.
Karen, I think you picked the best one.
Oh, thank you. This is when Cora was channeling her inner Sokka, a.k.a. me, saying the morning is evil because, ugh, I hate mornings.
Doesn't he say that exact line in Atla?
He says, like, the morning is evil or something.
It's something really close to it.
That's cute. I always wonder if Cora has influences and traits that she's inherited from Toph, Sokka, Katara, etc. Just from, like, having Aang's spirit and having them as friends. Like, if she'll pick up lines like the morning is evil from just, like, having known, quote-unquote, Sokka just so recently.
I don't really think so, just because then wouldn't Aang have had, like, hey, my best friend is Fire Lord Ozai, like, syndrome.
Yeah.
But anyway, my...
Well, he does
my...
feel quite a lot of compassion for Ozai, I have to say.
No, I don't. I probably should have been on the finale. I don't. He sucks. But my favorite line was, you know, when Cora is kind of roughing up the equalist... propagandist guy, and she was and the police were like, hey, what's going on over there? And the equalist propagandist guy was like, the Avatar is oppressing us. I just love that.
Like, I love how she picks him up with one arm and just holds him there. It's so cool.
Cora is way stronger than any, probably all of Rewatch almost. All right, so does anyone have any last thoughts on the revelation? Cool, so let's move on to A Voice in the Night, Chapter 4. In this episode, enter Asami Sato, beautiful, luxurious, and a daughter of a billionaire... and the daughter of a billionaire philanthropist. Yeah, we'll leave out the other descriptors, probably. After Asami nearly runs Mako over, Mako immediately tosses aside his old bae Cora for fancy dinners and carriage rides through Central Park. Teenage boy logic. Very true. Mr. Sato agrees to pay the Fire Ferret's pro-bending ante, and all is well in the world of pretty rich teenage land. Meanwhile, Cora has nightmares about the rally and is being pressured by Councilman Tarlok to join his anti-equalist task force. Tarlok is smelly and probably needs to wash his dreads, but Cora nonetheless is pressured into joining his little club at a forced press conference. The task force takes in an equalist training session, leaving Cora thirsting for blood. She challenges Amon to a duel at Avatar Aang Island, but the baddie instead ambushes her and informs her that she needs to reach level 65 and get all 8 badges before facing the Elite Four. Is that the Pokemon reference?
That's the Pokemon, yeah.
Okay. At least I got that was the Pokemon reference. So we are introduced to another major player in this episode, Asami Sato. Karen and Brittany, how do you feel about Asami Sato?
I don't like her.
Whoa.
I don't trust really? Her. I don't like her. She seems so like, oh my gosh, I just happened to hit you with my moped. Oh my god, let's go out on a date. Oh my god, let's meet my really rich dad and let me buy you things. And I just feel like there's something else going on there. And she seems a little slimy to me. I don't like her.
But that hair flip after she takes off her helmet.
I mean, she's beautiful, but that doesn't mean anything if you have a cold, cold heart.
Her hair is more luxurious than Thor's. And that's saying something.
I mean, I definitely see where Karen's coming from. I think that everything was a little too rushed with her being like, I mean, the let's have dinner thing. I was like, okay, this girl likes to take charge. But then she's like, okay, now here's my father and here's this and I'm going to buy you clothes and you have to be dressed a certain way. And she's very, I mean, don't get me wrong, Mako in the new clothing with his hair a little brushed back. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's just like, I agree. She's a little too free for
and the moment. Even if she's being genuine, I guess I don't really like her attitude in terms of like, yeah, I have all this money and I have a super rich and famous dad. You know, I can spend money on you because what is money? I feel like even that cavalier attitude doesn't really sit well with me either.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And in my humble opinion, I like to say that she might be compared to one Christian Grey from the fact that she kind of just like picks up with like, you know, a street urchin from the street, decides she likes it, dresses it up, tells it what to do, gives it money, and dates it. And it's just like, you're mine.
Oh my god, Mitch.
Wow. Okay.
Although I'm assuming Asami doesn't have a red room of pain. That's okay.
I can't breathe. Let's
not red.
Anyway, okay, so we're definitely getting a lack of trust vibe, which I think is very valid from the newbies. How do you feel about Hiroshi, her dad?
He seems cool. I like him. Kind of the same cavalier attitude a little bit, but I feel like maybe because he was the one that earned it, that he was the one that invented the cars, whatever they're called. I feel like maybe that's a little more, I don't know. It makes more sense.
Yeah. And I feel like he's one of those guys who's like, I worked hard. I know what's a good investment. If my daughter tells me you have a good character, like that's fine. It's like a story we've kind of heard before somewhere else. Maybe not in the Avatar universe, but.
Well, it almost starts to feel like Annie in a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. And then he's like, you know, giving his daughter the life she never had, like, or he never had, I'm sorry. So, like, he's like, okay, like, you can have this bike, you can do whatever you want, you, like, I believe, you know. I feel like she doesn't take advantage of him, but she's also, like, she doesn't understand what the work that goes into having that is.
Well, speaking of kind of having things, you know, Korra and Mako, as we just discussed, had this sort of semi maybe possible budding romance. And how do you guys feel that Mako is definitely now Team Asami? Mitchell, how did you feel about this, I guess? Looking back,
how did I feel about it? How do I feel about Mako? I think you know by now how I feel about Mako, don't you, Michal? I think we have very similar opinions on Mako, and I'll save my opinions for his later actions now. But from what exactly he's doing here, and of course how I've mentioned he's only nice to Korra when he needs her, he's also very mood swingy. Okay, please don't kill me, everyone. I know I'm making kind of like two Twilight references, but he's like an Edward Cullen, all right? He switches so quick, I don't know how Korra is supposed to follow it. It's just like it's obnoxious. I can't stand people like that. I can't stand characters like that. So it's weird that he's just like so into Asami, and maybe he's just more vain and he's into like the money and the beauty of it all, and it's just like, oh, Avatar, whatever. She's like not my type. Because it's just, it's so strange the way he treats Korra compared to Asami. And also how, like I wrote, he just drops Korra like she's a hot potato. Doesn't even like think about it. And I know that they weren't committed to each other. I feel like there would have been a courtesy thing rather than just being like, this is Asami, here she is. More of like, hey Korra, I have a new friend Asami, I'm bringing her to the party. You know, like not just show up with her like that. That's because Asami's like, I've heard so much about you. And Korra's like, I've heard nothing about you, which is legitimate because they're on like a team together. At least they have like a kinship there. And Mako is just not winning many brownie points with me so far in this rewatch.
They don't have cell phones, though. It's not like he could text her like, FYI, bring in girl.
Didn't yeah, we say an Atla?
This is not like this played out over weeks and they've had like practices in between or anything like that. So I feel like he has, like, I don't know if he's fallen hard, but there's this girl there who's not immediately combating him from the get-go, like, being like, oh, what's your problem sort of deal. It's more of, like, tell me more. I want to know everything. Like, she's interested in him and not so much, like, oh, we're going to be on the same team together or, you know, I'm interested kind of in learning a little bit more about you and your brother, but first of all, how can you help me?
Brittany, she almost murders him.
Yes, but that was by accident.
Korra was just there. She was, like, just chilling. And all of a sudden, he just, oh, get your fangirls out of here, Bolin.
Listen. I like
that. I smell this brew, Brit. I smell it.
Well, anyway, I mean, I don't really judge that much because I don't, you know, I don't think... I was surprised. I think I remember the first time I watched that, I was like, get your hands on Mako, he is Korra's. But they really, I mean, just like the very barest, I mean, they weren't even flirting, you know, they like, you know, whatever. Karen, do you have any specific thoughts on this? Or are you safe out of this conversation?
I mean, I don't like love it, but I think Honestly, the thing that bothered me the most about that and whole scene was how jealous Korra was, because I was sort of like, just grow up, like, he can do what he wants, and yes, I realize that you are jealous and everything, but it's not like you staked a claim, you guys barely know each other, so, I don't know.
I followed you there, and I'm not into this for, like, a shipping standpoint, because I don't really care at this rate who Mako's with. He's too new of a character for me to really ship so specifically with someone. Atla took a sweet time shipping, yes, I know, Katara and Aang, but really Zutara. But this show really just, like, right off the bat is so into shipping, and I think I can imagine, like, a little fangirl in my head saying, fangirl or boy, just the term, saying, like, how dare, like, Korra and Mako had something going on. No, that's not the thing. It's just Mako's attitude toward Korra as a person. Like, he's not treating her right, and he feels like he's kind of just been, like, dragging her in and out of, like, his good graces, and I don't like that. It's almost like if I was Korra, I would say, you know what, he's not even worth my time. I shouldn't even bother talking to him because he just can't make up his mind with what he wants in life, and he's insecure, so go ahead. Have your, like, pretty L'Oreal girl. Enjoy her.
Wow. Okay. Well, we definitely know where Mitchell stands. We also learn the origin of the scarf, you know.
Oh my God, Isaac Leahy. That's all I have to say.
Is that a Teen Wolf reference?
It was.
Okay. I'll let it go. But really the main part of this episode is Korra and her, you know, dealing with this fear that she is extremely unfamiliar with feeling. You know, we start the episode and she has this horrifying nightmare about being attacked and having her bending taken away. How did you like the beginning of this episode? Like this kind of bait and switch and then kind of opening up onto Korra, who is like distinctly more hesitant than we've seen her in the past three episodes. Brittany, how about you?
I think Mitch put it in here. I was kind of convinced that the beginning was real and that we were going to flash back. Like, it was sort of like a flash forward and then we were going to, like, go back and, like, get to that point. But I like that it was, like I was saying about the last episode, I like that how real this fear is and how deep it's gone into Korra. Like, it's, like, really shaken her. And I think, I don't know. I mean, I like where they're going with it, to say that this is never going to go away. It's not like we're going to have like 5 episodes of like, you know, a bending tournament, and then like we're going to forget that this is going on. I think it's going to be a really big problem for her. And she has to worry about mastering another element that she can't even begin to like produce any proof of air yet. So.
Well, she can go through the leaf spinny thingy.
Yeah,
that
she
was exciting. Yeah. And it's nice. Fixed. I was so happy to see that it's fixed.
Oh yeah. Karen, you were so upset. It was so adorable. You're like, I am a history major, that is not okay.
And Karen, how do you feel about Cora's kind of psychology in this episode?
Really interesting. I think it's important to delve into that part of her, because physically she is going through a lot of tough times in terms of getting her airbending going and everything, but I think it's really important to kind of look at the mental state of her as well, especially when we're talking about having like all your chakras open and being spiritual, which we know is difficult for her. And I think it all just really ties in together. And I also wanted to say, with the opening and the nightmare, that normally I wouldn't be tricked by that. I would be like, okay, yeah, this isn't going to be real. But because the show is moving so quickly, I was like, oh my God, I literally have no idea if this is happening or not. So I was a little surprised that it ended up being a nightmare.
Yeah, they definitely keep you on your toes a lot, I think, in this episode. Even just, you know, at the end, when you think it's like, okay, fine, Cora did this kind of stupid thing, but it didn't turn out to be anything. And then, oh my God, Amon is there, you know.
Are nightmares like that fair to a viewer when you're watching a show, any show, and a big plot point is revealed, either in fantasy, in a hallucination, or a nightmare? And I find myself very upset when that happens in shows, because it feels like, I mean, Karen, you know a lot of this too from how I feel during Teen Wolf, where a character will die and come back. I've kind of reconciled myself there. But I think no matter what, I'm always going to have these fake fantasies that reveal a big plot point, but they really didn't happen. I don't like my heart tug like that. I need to know for real what happened. I like one reality. I don't like it's nice to see Cora's psyche. I get it, that it's a nice representation of that. I just wish that didn't have to come along with, you know, creating such a realistic bait and switch. It was very effective, but it still made me upset.
Don't watch Hannibal. That's every single episode.
Oh, you're kidding me. No, I'm not watching it anymore.
Every single episode.
That's horrible. Well he's crazy, so I guess that makes sense.
The thing is, Mitch, I think that, you know, this is the perfect use of a dream, because that's what a dream is. You know, like when you're in a dream, you're not like, this is too realistic. You know, like it's not, it doesn't, you aren't like, I'm telling the audience too much about my internal fears right now. Like Cora is experiencing this because she is afraid. You know, I think if this had been, I don't know, whatever, something else, maybe we can talk about the flashbacks, you know, in this context. But I think that this particular illustration of it was scary. And again, like, how old is this show? Like, what is it aimed for? And just, you know, a lot of those kind of things.
If you want to compare it back to like Atla nightmares, of course, in the episode before the hashtag the beach part 2.
Yeah, do we have to talk about nightmares
and daydreams? Oh, I know. And those dreams were, I think, appropriate, because I never once believed that they were really happening, and that's how I wanted them to happen in Cora. But it's just such a different style that wouldn't have worked. Like I said, I know why it was done. I understand and I appreciate that. I still don't like it. It's kind of like a necessary evil at this point, because how else are we going to show Cora's, you know, like superstitions, but her I can't think of the right word, but her fright of Amon.
And, you know, she's obviously not the only one who is worried about Amon. We meet Councilman Tarlok. We also meet the whole council. It seems like Republic City is run by this council of, benders, which that sounds like a very smart idea in this political climate. And Tarlok is basically, according to the way Mitch describes him, is a very evil-looking slash smelly waterbender regarding breaking traditions. And yeah, he, you know, is a man with a plan. He says what he wants, gets what he wants. He's very skilled at manipulating Cora into playing right into his hands, basically. Even when she actively tries not to. So Karen, how did you feel about Councilman Tarlok?
Ugh, I did not like him at all. He's so slimy. And I was surprised that Cora said at first, no, I'm not going to help you. And I was like, okay, cool. Maybe they're going in a different direction with this. And then it ended up that he kept, like, yes, here's a car. Come, you know, fight this guy with me. Like, I don't understand why he thought that would have worked. But I guess, you know, don't knock it till you try it. and then he tricks her publicly. And I think that's such a horrible, horrible way to do that. And I feel like he must have an ulterior motive, too. I mean, just the way that he was drawn. I was looking up his name, so I had to Google him, and I went to images, and I just skimmed. I try not to look too closely.
That's super dangerous. I know.
I try not to look too closely, just like when I did the Avatar article, the Korra article for last week. I was like, oh my god, I hope I don't get spoiled. So far, so good. But just the way he's drawn, he's so imposing, he's so dark, he's so angular, and I'm like, that just must be a clue. So I think he's evil.
And Brittany, how about you?
Yeah, I do not like him at all. When he got Cora, like, on the steps, like, kind of to just, like, have to come out and say how she really felt, and it could be twisted in any way he wanted, and he knew what he was doing. And I think it's just, he's the type of person, like, the type of, like, villainous character that I cannot stand. Because there's no way to fight them because they find ways to twist everything. And he's like, I do not like him. He's so slimy.
That's why I'm afraid that she's on his team now, because I feel like he's going to set her up. Like, they're going to go in on a raid or something, and all of a sudden, like, the lights are going to come on, and she's going to be in the middle of a room of, like, dead, I don't know, benders or dead non-benders. Sweetie. And he's going to be like, hey, look, she's the bad guy now.
Yeah. Okay, so then, as a point of speculation, we've talked about a lot of people thinking that they may be bad guys. Who's who in this whole Amon scheme, if they're connected or if they're not connected? Like, where are you seeing this stuff come together, newbies?
I don't know if we know who Amon is. If he's really burned, then maybe he'll be masked the whole time and we won't actually, like, I don't think we've met him already. I think Tarlok is possibly one of his lackeys.
I agree with that.
Because I don't know if this is a crack theory. Well, I'm hearing yours. I'm not validating any. I'm just reading from the doc. That Ariana said that quote for Asami, obviously, she is Amon. She uses a voice synthesizer, guys, a.k.a. Azula's love child. So that's very specific.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of love children in Ariana's
universe. So true.
And, I mean, I support every theory 100%, but there are definitely a lot of them.
There are a lot of theories to be had at this point, and I'm happy that you all are set on one given thing, because I love hearing your speculation. It's so much fun. This is, like, such a treat for us super fans. I love it.
It's actually very funny, because it gives me a lot of flashbacks to discussing the early days of Korra. It's basically the same conversations we were all having. Although I'm not sure if Asami as Amon as a love child was on that particular list, but you know, my memory, you know, it was 2012.
I can't with Ariana. Oh my god, even when she's not on the episode, she still has like that flair in here.
Yeah. So you know, this kind of brings us to our major showdown of the episode. Cora, you know, obviously helps out Tarlok because she is, you know, very cleverly set up by him, and kind of, I guess, gets on an adrenaline high. I think she kind of, you know, she sees this as a way of conquering her fear, and she goes for it, and she, you know, calls Adam on, on Avataring Island, of all places, which is, like, massively and enormously ironic. So how did you guys think that showdown was gonna go down? Did you think it was, you know, really gonna happen, or he wasn't gonna show, or Korra was completely doomed, or what were your thoughts?
I honestly thought it was going to play out almost the way that it did, where she was gonna wait around and then, like, they were gonna come in. I thought that they were gonna take her, though. That was the only difference, was that they were going to take her at the end, but that he wasn't going to show up alone, and that he was going to have all these lackeys there, and they were going to just sort of take away her, like, you know, chi block, or not exactly take away her bending at that particular moment, but take her and make an example of her, like, sort of like a hostage type tape situation.
Yeah, I don't know if I really thought that it was going to play out the way that it did. I knew it wasn't going to end well, because, like it says in the doc, it was too early to have this showdown. So I was like, yeah, this is going to end poorly. I was expecting Amon to show up right on time, and I was really surprised that he didn't. And I was like, all right, how is this going to play into his plans? Because he seems like a coward right now, and turns out that because he had a much better plan. And I think that those final moments where she was taken, I was like, oh my god, are they going to take her powers away? Is this going to happen so soon? And, you know, just like with the nightmare, who knows at this point, because the story is moving so fast that anything could happen. So I really have no idea. And I was pretty nervous, but the fact that he didn't do it was like, okay, there's a bigger story here. And that actually makes me even more scared than I already am.
And Mitch, you noted that, the show, I wouldn't necessarily say wrote it itself into a corner, but I think actually had the opportunity to surprise us, which is that, you know, Korra obviously is so gung-ho, and she is so obviously not fearless, but she tackles problems in a completely different way than Aang does. And, you know, having Amon as this kind of, like, just, like, almost impenetrable force, you know, not to mention someone who's very hard to get to himself, as opposed to, like, you know, being surrounded by his swarm of bug ninjas. So, you know, they kind of were on this collision course, and it was, you know, how do you think, like, were you happy that it played out like this? Or, you know, obviously Amon doesn't take away Korra's bending, and the way he puts it, you know, she would turn into a martyr if he took her bending at this stage. And I don't know, how did you feel about that?
It's obviously very difficult to comment on this because I know the final outcome, and I know the plan, and that's what, you know, Karen and Brittany were just speculating, like, what's the plan here? So I'll leave all opinion outside of that. As opposed to just then what I wrote about having a not lazy avatar that wanted to fight the big bad right then and there. I'm confused only by the fact that Korra was too weak to properly duel. From that specific standpoint, why Amon, if that's one theory, not the martyr theory, but another theory of why he didn't, you know, take her or whatever, wouldn't Korra be able to destroy him on a one-on-one? Is at this point, in Anubi's opinion, would you think so, Karen and Brittany, that she'd be able to win against him with her three elements?
I don't think that she would, but why would he want that? Like, why, if you are going to go up against the Avatar, you want to go up against and prove something. Someone could easily be like, oh, well, I mean, she only knew three elements. Like, what if she had been able to do everything? You know, you want to save that. You want to save that big, bad duel, you know, and you want to be the best that you can and beat the best that there is, which would be someone who has mastered all four elements.
Oh, okay. So that's a good point then. So it's kind of an Amon's pride to wait for her to really become the master that he wants her to be so that he can take down a large adversary.
Yeah, because even, like, in that first press conference, like, everyone knows that she is there because she needs to learn airbending. Like, they know that she's not done training yet, the whole world, just and simply because of that press conference. Like, she's being relocated here because she needs to work on her airbending. So, like, even, like, the world already knows that if he were to beat her now, she's not a full-fledged avatar.
Well, that's not even my question. Do you think Korra would have won this duel mono y mono, as she had requested.
Yeah, no, I started out and I said no, I don't think so, because...
No, okay. Karen, do you think she would have won?
Do I think Korra would have beat him?
Yes. Just one-on-one. No bugs, ninjas, guys.
No, because I feel like he has something else up his sleeve, and I don't know what it is. Maybe he is a bender, who knows, but I feel like if he's that confident going up against her, there's got to be a reason.
Okay. Outside of everything, because I can't comment on anything, I understand that, Brittany, you made a really good point about the pride he'd feel about taking down the Colossus, Avatar, all four elements, supermastered, right? But there's also, I think, a shame in what he did, because she was, if you're man enough, you'll come fight me. It'll just be the two of us. And it kind of reminds me of many a duel in Atla, where it would be like, okay, this is just between me and you, and it's Azula and Zuko, right? And that's kind of hairy territory, because Katara was there too. But it always feels like there's a certain pride in having a one-on-one battle that Amon just simply doesn't have here. He has no qualms with inviting his whole crew, because she's like, don't bring your equalists, it's going to be just us. And it seems like Korra's team seems to follow that, because no one's there to save her, but he has his whole team there, and it really feels... like Amon is he's running his own ship here. He really doesn't need to follow the commands of anyone, because he doesn't have that kind of pride.
See, I honestly I the reason I like Amon is because he's not, like, at least at this point, his ego has not really come into it. You know, we don't really know how egotistical or self-serving or whatever he may actually be or may not be. I think what's interesting about this is that he had no intention of giving Korra a chance to fight against him. You know, he wasn't like, you know, whether or not he didn't accelerate the plan. He wasn't like, I'm just going to destroy the Avatar right now. He also wasn't impressed by the whole thing. You know, he was like, I'm using this to teach you a lesson, you know, and implement my plan in that way, not to accomplish any, I guess, tactile idea, which is very interesting, because Korra basically in this episode comes up against, I guess, three kind of psychological villains / obstacles: Amon, Tarlok, and her own terror, you know, which is something really interesting. And I think they just handle it so well, and something, it's like so fascinating to watch. And, you know, obviously Avatar had a lot of psychology going on, but the idea that in episode 4 we're dealing with, like, you know, deep matters of the heart, I think is very, very impressive for Korra.
I mean, Kyle, without commenting on exactly what it may be or anything at all, because I do know that this would be a spoiler, so I'll leave everything out. All I need to say to you, Mikal, and any super fan, is season four, and maybe I could even just say, you might, no, I'm going to stop there, but there's something here that I want to come back to, something in season one that I want to come back to when we're at season four, because I want everyone to kind of have an aha moment with me to be like, oh my God, you were right, because I think it's really cool what I just connected. I'll write to you after, Mikal, but it's going to be,
and now we're waiting
very,
for
it's going to be, guys, very rewarding. I'll give you that much.
Nothing happens in season four.
Nothing. But I think you needed to have me tease you here so that you could really think it up. And then when you get to this moment, you're going to be like,
no, I don't want to think about it. I want to come to my own aha moment. Like,
you have a, you have plenty of aha moments to come. I'll give you that.
Go on.
Anyway, moving on. I guess kind of the last important thing to touch on is that Korra has flashbacks to the gang.
Did you see Aang? Did everyone see Aang? Because, listen,
yes.
I was into it. I was like, wow, look at Aang.
Yep.
My God.
He's all grown up.
I was so excited.
So I remember, like, when I saw this for the first time, I, like, legit flipped out. Because we also see Sokka. We get a glimpse of Toph. It's just, like, really exciting to see. And also, I think... gives us a hint that there's a lot more mythology going on here than maybe, you know, and understandably so. I think the show kind of minimized its connection initially to the past, because they really did want to establish themselves on their own ground. But at this point, they kind of, like, kind of take a step back and go like, past is still important, you know, like we'll get there. So I think it would be kind of useless to talk to you about this, Mitch, but, Karen and Brittany, how did you guys feel? What do you think this might mean?
That we're going to get much more insight as to what happened during the last 70 years. Well, at least I hope so. I want to learn more about Aang, to be honest. And I want to know where Zuko is, because this is getting frustrating. Like, really frustrating for me. Every week I'm like, come on, we can do it. Oh, but I do have a question about, speaking of flashbacks, there's a giant statue of a firebender. Is that Zuko? I've paused it, I've screenshot it, and I couldn't tell if he had a scar on his face.
Maybe it's on the wrong side.
Maybe Zuko decided to Photoshop his statue.
Yeah. Well, I was looking at this I spent way too much time looking at this one statue, let me tell you. Because I'm that invested in Zuko.
Mikal, do you know? I know it's the one that Bolt's sitting underneath when he's doing his Pabu tricks.
And yeah, it's that one.
I don't remember. There's a lot of statues in this city.
There are. I'll give you that
kind of just, like, peppered it with all of their faces.
Can we just say it's possible? Like, it could be Zuko's statue?
Yeah, it totally could be Zuko. I don't remember. I do remember that we see more statues, but I don't remember specifically seeing Zuko or not.
Yeah, but...
Because just so far, you've seen Brittany, obviously, Avatar Aang's, and then there's one more, and I think you've seen it, so I won't say it. I'll let you finish it.
What am I finishing?
Okay. No, what's the other statue that we've seen so far?
Oh, just Aang.
Okay, cool. Cool. We'll leave it at that.
Giant, terrifying Aang. I'm very afraid of, large things. So, I'm afraid of the Statue of Liberty. So,
what do you think it's going to do?
It's freaked me out.
Life, obviously.
It's not what it's going to do, Mitch. It's what it could do.
I mean, has anybody seen Doctor Who,
guys? Come on.
Yeah, come on. Weeping Angel. Sorry, Brittany.
Is that the episode where it takes two years to get to Brooklyn?
What?
I don't know. I don't watch Doctor Who, but somebody told me yesterday that she'd heard of an episode of Doctor Who where it takes people 2 years to get to Brooklyn. And
I mean, that's pretty realistic, isn't it?
So I was just wondering if we had a really funny coincidence and you referenced the same episode 2 days in a row. Anyway,
I'm just talking traffic.
Karen, what did you think about this crazy awesome flashback?
Definitely exciting. Definitely excited to see Aang, and I want more. Pretty much what Brittany said.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What do you think they were doing in that flashback, and were there multiple scenes, or was it just one?
Honestly, it went so fast that I don't even really remember what I saw. I kind of want to go back and watch it again, but yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of cool just to wait and see what happens.
Yeah. But I think that there are multiple scenes, cause Toph is standing in front of people and Sokka's somewhere else. And Aang's kind of in action. So I feel like Toph just want to be standing there with people behind her if Aang was in action. So
he's in action. What do you think he's doing?
He's moving very fast at the camera, allowing us to see his still pubescent facial hair growing ability, because you can even grow a full beard. It's weird. This half thing, it's weird.
I think it's called a chin strap.
A chin strap, yes.
How old do you think?
I feel like there was some styling that went into that, but Aang was just this is all I got.
how old do you think the gang is in general in this scene, if you had to just ballpark it?
Oh, I have no idea. It was 2 seconds, but maybe 30s, 40s.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking all these, Brittany, is because last time you caught Azula before Azula was a thing.
Oh, I did. I was that camera is lingering a little too long on that person right there. And then I had to wait almost 3 seasons. I felt seasons for her to finally come back.
That was great. I'll never forget that moment. Well, cool. Okay.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of our discussion. Karen, what was your favorite scene in The Voice in the Night?
This is when Tarlok first showed up, and the Tenzin's wife and his youngest daughter had these identical looks of disgust on their face. The first one was when he came in and Tenzin was like, yeah, I guess you can stay. And his wife was just like, seriously. And then the little girl had the same exact look on her face. And it was super adorable. But I also wanted to just point out like how expressive they can be sometimes. And I feel like that's definitely a step up from Avatar. I mean, we got some of that in Avatar, but it was a lot more animated. Like, I know that's kind of silly, they're both animated, but it was more of a silly, like, unrealistic kind of animation, whereas I feel like this is more realistic, and it was just great. I like seeing it.
Yeah, I agree. I'm actually, I prefer the animation of Korra. I think it's stunning, with certain exceptions that we'll discuss in due time, but season one just blows me away. Mitch, what about you?
Yeah, so mine is, once again, within the world of animation, as in detail, that Korra was running after the escaping equalists. In the way it was choreographed, it didn't feel like a storyboard like some moments in Korra do to me. I think it's because I've seen way too many behind the scenes, this is how we draw the action stuff. But this scene felt so organic and so real. It almost kind of reminds me, oddly enough, of Daredevil, and specifically of that long camera shot, Karen. That I remember you liking a lot.
My favorite ever.
Gives me chills, right? Just so much action happening in one long string, right? And it feels very like it just happened. There wasn't any like dramaticism to it. It was just it was there, and that was what had happened. I don't know how else to describe it. I really appreciate that. I won't say a long caveat for animation because I agreed with that comment is the most I think we have time to say. That there are moments that one studio is developing and it looks great, and another moments when it doesn't, and we'll note those as it comes along. But sorry if I was blanket statementing too much when I was saying that the animation in general in Korra isn't as good as Atla. I do have moments like this that I think are absolutely beautiful.
Brittany, what about you?
I like Asami's introduction. How do you say your name? Is it Asami?
Asami.
Asami. Yeah. I liked her introduction. I think that there's a lot to learn with her. But I will say, also, because I was thinking about this while I was watching it the first time, and the moment at the end of the episode where it was sort of like Tenzin was telling her, like, oh, you, like, you're on, like, this is a great path to be on because you just unlocked, like, fear, and fear is the first chakra that you need to unlock. And I was, because the whole time, the first two episodes, I'm like, well, she can't airbend because her chakras are blocked, duh. And
oh, wow. Like,
that was the only thing I was thinking. I was like, oh.
So well, clearly, Tenzin, you have not seen the guru.
Yeah. I was like, clearly, this is your problem. And then when he said that, I was like, see, look, we're on a good path here. We're unlocking chakras. Like, this is good. She's going to airbend soon. So.
Oh, I love yours. I love your either assumptions or your theories. They're just so much fun. I love it.
Well, my favorite scene was Korra's complete and utter lack of chill against Amon, and he just being like, I am not concerned with you, you little child. Like, you are serving my purposes, not the other way around. And I think really, you know, like last week, because that's how we watched it when it came out, but like the revelation made me pay attention, and the voice in the night made me obsessed with Korra. That was the switch. I was like, I desperately need to see the next episode. And yeah, so moving on to favorite lines. Karen, what was your favorite line?
Mine was from the youngest daughter again, Ikki, and it's when she says, why do you have three ponytails and why do you smell like a lady? You're weird. And she says that to the dude.
Tarlok.
Tarlok, thank you. The names are so hard to remember.
Don't try and spell them.
Oh, God. And, yeah, that was not fun. And go ahead, Karen. Yeah, I remember now. McCall, we have moments like that.
She's just super adorable, and I like how she says it like it is.
Mitch, what about you?
Okay, Karen. We got some beef over here. I'm the doc writer. I get to pick the cream of the crop. What do you do?
No,
you
come in and snipe it
as I'm writing the doc.
Look, you should have put yours in first.
We have 20 weeks to go. Let's just not fight about this now.
Okay, so
Natalie's time, okay?
So, all right. I had to take a second best here, but I'm still happy with it. Asami, I know it sounds weird to say this, but I'm really glad I hit you with my moped.
I hate you, Mitchell.
Was that yours?
No, it was just the sarcasm dripping off your voice.
Oh, yeah, no.
Brittany, what's your favorite line?
Mine was from Mako. This is going to be a running theme, like, where I only picked Boomy lines for a while. he was like, the scarf stays. I just thought it was, like, it was so great, and he was very, because they went to go take it, and it was sort of like a Mockingjay pin moment, where she put the pin back on. It was like,
wait, are you telling me you've replaced Boomy with Mako?
Oh, no. I'm not replacing Boomy with anyone. That's, like, okay. Unless this new Boomy 2.0, whoever he is, comes out of the woodwork and is just, like, amazing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Scarves and pins connected to the feels. My favorite line was, and it's tied to his expression, obviously. And I don't usually like bathroom jokes, but this one really won me over. When Tenzin is at the party and he's dressed up all fancy, and then he's like, Milo, no, that is not a toilet! And his face turns like eggplant purple. Okay. And awesome. Just because Milo is obviously like a 5-year-old boy, and 5-year-old boys pee wherever they want, or wherever they think would be entertaining, especially when you're Milo. So yeah, I enjoyed that one.
He's so stoic. Tenzin is so stoic. And then those moments that he loses it, it's just priceless.
Yeah.
And it's funny, job. Too, because I can almost imagine the whole scene playing out. Like, they left just the right amount to the imagination where you could see Milo kind of just, like, sitting with the grin, like, on a, like, a urn or something. And it really cracks me up. I like Milo, especially season one Milo, to the T, because he's so... just fabulous. He gives you such a fun element to the show.
Yeah. They point and counterpoint a lot of the elements really well on this show. So that brings us to the end of our episode discussions. But if you would like to contact us and tell us, you know, how amazing we are, or, you know, maybe something other than that, you can email us at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. Twitter is @re_watchable. This post on hyphenable.com. I always check those obsessively, to be completely honest. And join us on Tumblr at rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. You can also leave us an iTunes review. Yes, these are back. If you rate us 5 stars, then I'm sorry, Mitch. I'm taking over. Mitch suggested that Karen will compliment your 3 ponytails and appropriate a designated smell to your self-identified gender. I, however, just say that Karen will wear 3 ponytails to Comic-Con.
Oh, come on.
I like
You're
that.
You're no fun.
That's doable. I could probably do that.
Is your hair long enough by Comic-Con time, if you're growing it out, to wear 3 ponytails?
No, but I'll make it work.
You can make him stick up, kind of like Bam Bam. Or, who's the girl from the Flintstones, right? Pebbles?
Yeah. Well, we have a lot of listener feedback actually this week, which is great. Let's just go in our regular order, if that's okay. So our first message comes from Sarah on Twitter. She's going to finish Orange is the New Black tomorrow after work, and then finally start Legend of Korra to watch with Rewatchable. And I haven't started Orange is the New Black yet, but I'm very flattered that we're on the same level and that Korra.
Right.
Yeah.
That was really flattering. I can't wait to watch it, but, like, wow, we're above Korra. Well, Korra's above, or we are. I'm not sure which.
Oh, it's us. It's definitely us.
Yes, definitely.
Karen, you want to take the next one?
Yes, this is from Lizzie Granger, and she says, I think that both the music and animation of Korra are beautiful and personally prefer them to Atlas. Love the podcast, BTW. Thank you so much for that. Really appreciate it. And yeah, so far I'm liking the music and animation, but I think it's going to take me a while to really decide which I prefer, but we'll let you know.
Yeah, that was Brittany. Definitely in response to me not liking the music.
Yeah, this is definitely a Brittany tweet.
Well, it's so funny that you said that, because it's the same guys.
So I know. Like, I just feel like the music, it just, for some reason, is so jarring. Like, it takes me out of the episode a lot more than I would like it to.
Whereas in
Atla, I didn't really notice it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And here, I'm noticing it all the time.
I'm just curious. Do you mean like the 20s they go on, or like the like atmospheric music?
Oh, no, no, no. It's the like, you know, like when they're like driving or like there's like car scenes or something like that. It's that 20s like loud, like big bandy type things.
Yeah.
That I do not like.
I hear that. I hear that. It's been, it's a definite process, adjusting. And I definitely took me a while to go through this process too, because I usually, most of my stories that I like are kind of pre-industrial, but it's definitely kind of a process adjusting to this kind of literally new world of Korra.
And there are moments still, Brittany, that I think you're going to absolutely love, where I think the music makes the scene, it makes it emotional. And there's one scene in particular that I can't wait till we get to it, because I cried because of the music, because I don't know if it cued back exactly to like a theme from Atla, but it definitely had vibes of it. And it makes like there's still going to be Atla like songs at appropriate times. So I don't think that the soundtrack is going to be completely devoid of that ambiance you're looking for, Britt, that gets you to that emotion. Because I know what you mean when the music's distracting to the point where you're like, okay, really, like I don't need to hear this like loud trumpet like blaring over the conversation.
Yeah, if I don't notice the atmosphere music, it's because I'm in the moment. It's doing its job. Whereas if it's taking me out of it, then it bothers me. That's my only complaint. So if I'm not noticing the music, then I'm great. I love it. I'm on board.
Mitch, you want to take the next one?
Sure. This comes in from Zach H. Official, and they wrote in, I just burst into uncontrollable laughter at the M. Night quote about why the live action Atla didn't catch on with adults. What is even happening anymore? And then he also said that he saved our email to his contacts, because let's be real, I'm going to need it. Ooh, we're going to get some emails from Zach now. This is going to be fun. I don't know if he's written in an email yet.
Yeah, I told, well, Zach was like, would it be okay if I email, like, a lot of my thoughts as long as they're spoiler-free? And I said, yeah, sure. You just get us the message. I'm like, I can't promise we'll read the whole thing, but we'll piece it apart if you do decide to write in.
Well, here's the thing. Adriana tends to not read the email, and I always check it. So it can be spoilery as long as you give a spoiler alert just in case. Because I still will keep that part to myself. But if you want to have some non-spoilery thoughts, they're more than welcome. We love them. Emails are really fun. I love reading out the in-depth theories that you guys have, too, or thoughts that you had if you're a super fan.
Mm-hmm. Who's next? Brittany, you want to take Avatar Central?
Sure. So Avatar Central, our good pals over at Avatar Central, said, the next two episodes for this week are pretty intense, meaning the ones we just watched, and I remember being so impressed. Keep up the good work. So thanks, Avatar Central. We love you.
Yes,
you talk
do.
To us all the time.
And we have another tweet from Kelsey Pays. Sorry, I hope that I'm pronouncing that right. And she pulls out the book that everybody references for Game of Thrones, which is especially relevant for tonight, 'cause it's the season finale of Game of Thrones. And oh my God. Wow. Sorry, I had to get one reference in. But she goes, or he goes, Grand Katara, it'd be like, all my friends are dead. Picture of a dinosaur.
Oh, and it's super relevant because of Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah, but they're alive then, so.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, they are.
Decided to revive that for some reason. Mitch, you want to take the next one?
Shelley Bookworm wrote, did any of you watch Play It Again, Dick? I'm finally checking out. For anyone not into the know of Veronica Mars, that was a web series that the character Dick did as Ryan Hansen. It was weird.
It was weird.
Yeah, because he like kind of acted as Dick, but he didn't act as Ryan Hansen, but he was supposed to be Ryan Hansen. It was just so strange. And most of the Veronica Mars characters came back on this little web series. They were like 3 minutes apiece, and it was on something called CW The Seed, which is another website or app that they're trying to like promote. I don't know. I think Rob Thomas was a little bit involved in it, but I don't think enough, because I don't know that it really caught my interest. There were some great Logan moments, I have to admit, because he's doing pull-ups, and that's all I'm going to say.
Ooh.
If you watched up to that episode, you've probably seen the best of it.
I didn't
just Google Logan doing pull-ups, and then you're good.
True. I didn't watch it yet. I think I watched the first one, and then honestly completely forgot about it. I'm a bad Veronica Mars fan, but I would like to watch it, if only for Logan doing pull-ups.
Oh, yes. No, that's worth it. And also, Rose McIver, who stars in iZombie, Rob Thomas's new project, is like a guest star, I guess, in one of the episodes. And it's really cute because she doesn't act like she does in iZombie at all. But it's like, oh, okay, so Rob Thomas kind of has like his Ryan Murphy or whatever kind of group. But did I say his name right, Brittany? Why am I forgetting him?
Yeah, you did.
Okay, I was thinking he's Mick Murphy for some reason. I don't know. Maybe I've been McDonald's too much recently. but it, yeah, it seems like Rob Thomas is kind of garnering his like Hollywood group of his stars from all the shows, and he gathers them together for fun projects like this. So I don't know. I'd like to support Veronica Mars in all ways that I can. I don't know if this is one of the ways that I really can become interested in the world, because it's not very much in the world. It's weird. I don't know. There's nothing more to say about it.
Well, moving back to Legend of Korra, we have a comment from Baylor. Do you want to take this one, Karen?
Yes. They say, sorry, I don't know. I don't want to assume anything. Is it just a coincidence that Mako, Bolin, and Korra all have the eye color to match their bending, or are eye color and bending traits linked together? I noticed that in these episodes too, and I was like, wow, that's so strange. So is this something that we could possibly be learning in the future, or is it not addressed?
He is strong.
Say that again?
I said the seed is strong. Hashtag Game of Thrones.
Well, think back to Atla and all the characters you know there. Can you think of, for instance, a brown-eyed waterbender?
I don't remember what their eye colors were.
Yeah, okay. This is pretty much the same. It's, I mean, Katara has blue eyes. Toph has green eyes. Obviously, they're a little bit light because she's blind. And Zuko and my inner shipper just Freudying its way in there. Zuko and Azula both had golden eyes, which is like the Fire Nation like royalty. So I don't remember. No, I got
what you just said. Oh God.
I don't remember what like standard Fire Nation people had, but I think this is more or less the same. I think they're very bright, their eyes, but I think it's kind of continued on from Avatar.
I kind of just remember, like, Iroh, for instance, having, like, gray eyes. Maybe I'm wrong. And even Aang's went a bit gray after they were, if he was, like, really emotive, but usually they were blue. Because, like, Avatar, like, you don't know, like, what even, like, an airbender should have. I don't know. What does Tenzin have?
Probably, like, light blue.
So it's, like, a lighter blue than the waterbenders, usually, we could say.
Yeah.
He has his mother's eyes.
Like, oh, stop. Do not. That is not okay, Brittany.
Someone does have his mother's eyes, but okay. Daniel Stewart says, I'm so excited to rewatch Korra with you guys. It is such an amazing series. I just wanted to point out that you guys forgot to mention Jinora's Avatar The Last Airbender comic callback when she asked Katara what happened to Zuko's mom, and Katara got cut off by Iki before she could answer. I just think that little exchange is hilarious. Yeah. I agree. I don't actually think it was specifically a callback to the comic, because I'm pretty sure this came out before that comic. But I think it was a reference to just the general fandom being like, but what happened to Zuko's mother? And like Mike and Brian being like, whole new show! And everybody being like, but Zuko's mother! Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that we had another person on Twitter ask us the same thing, why we didn't bring it up. And I was like, well, first of all, a lot of us didn't read the comics, meaning like the newbies didn't really read the comics. I read the first part of the cert, whatever the one is where they go to find Zuko's mom. I read the first one. And so I don't think it was like on our minds at the time.
Can we get to a point?
But we're sorry.
Or will we get to a point on Rewatchable? This is a Karen question. Where we just kind of like define it as like, okay, one more week to read the search and then we'll talk about it. Or do we just want to like never mention it because it's kind of like outside of the TV show canon-ish?
I mean, I definitely want to stick with the show, but usually on our like outro episodes, we do a lot of random wrap-up type of things. So we could always maybe mention it there if everybody's on board with it. We'll just have to play it by ear.
That's cool, because I'm just curious myself in that I just really want to discuss everything, but it's weird territory, you know?
Mitch, you want to take the last comment?
Sure. This comes from Sipai. They wrote in, "Hi, guys. I'm so happy you're back. It's so interesting. Some of you guys have mixed feelings about Cora's attitude. I struggled with her to begin with as well, but everyone else seemed to love her when I first watched it. So I thought I was just being weird because she's so different from Aang, as she's so strong and abrasive. I even critically analyzed myself, asking if I would feel the same if she had been the if she had the same traits but was a man."
Good, kind of good on you. Her. Yes. Self-awareness. Yeah, I approve of this.
Me too. That was really cool of you, Sakai. I kind of liked her, but honestly, it took me a while to warm up for her. I like her a lot more on the rewatch, though.
I mean, I think that's a very good point. I never really understood people being like, oh, I don't like her because she's so different from Aang. Like, that was never something that really resonated with me, maybe just because I was a little older when I watched it. But I definitely get that Korra has a very distinct personality, and it's not always a personality that we're used to seeing in female characters. Certainly not female characters who are the center of their show, you know? So I think it's, you know, like, I don't judge anyone for, like, having to come around on Korra. You know, I think if you go through the whole thing, like, saying, like, oh, she's too loud and I hate her and blah, 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 then maybe we have a problem. But, like, people adjust to characters at different speeds.
Well, the hard part about this show is that because she has a much more abrasive attitude toward life than Aang, who is very passive and just don't hurt anyone, please, you know, and she's like, no, gonna kill Aman, bye. So the difference there is that essentially, I think that, yes, you know what her personality is right now, but it's going to be the journey. It's going to be the evolution of the show that's going to attach you to all the characters in it. And it's kind of, I mean, almost akin to even shows with villains that you end up liking. Like, I'm sure Dexter, I never watched it. I know Hannibal, Brittany. I know you have some affection for that man by now. So it starts to feel like, just from even seeing, like, the Orange is the New Black journey of all these criminals, of all these people you don't like, you're bound to still have feelings for them because you've seen them go through so much that you don't have a way to, like, still feel cold-hearted toward them. And if you do, then you're a rare breed, because I think few people will not care about these characters at the end of the series, much like Atla.
Cool. Very, very awesome. We also have one iTunes review. Fantastic. Karen, why don't you take this one?
Okay. It's from JD Fan, and they say, "Amazing podcast. This podcast is one that I would recommend to anyone. I love the concept of rewatching older or off-the-air shows. So excited for Legend of Korra." Thank you so much, JD Fan. I think I have to dance like nobody's watching now, so I really appreciate that.
Ooh. All right.
Don't forget, guys, claim your iTunes incentives when you write the review in the review, and then she'll have no definitive way to ever deny you it.
That's true.
I feel like we should have a hashtag, like, hashtag sorry Karen or something like that.
We have a classic Adiana, so now we need, like, hashtag sorry Karen. Yeah,
well, it can be both an adjective and a, you know, explanation. All right, so that has been all for this week's episode of Rewatchable. Thank you so much for listening, and join us next week when we will be discussing, what is it, episode 5, which is I remember episode 5. Well, it doesn't really matter. You can look it up. But there are two very, very interesting episodes for next week. And thank you so much for listening. I've been Michal.
I'm Karen.
I'm Mitch.
And I'm Brittany.